Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. My goodness, it's so good to be here with you today. Coming to you live from southern Mississippi, our AccuWindow forecast is stormy. We're in between tornadoes tonight, but we're glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. We're high and dry in a secret location in southern Mississippi. The solar wind tonight is a brisk 413 kilometers per second, and there are so many sunspots on the sun, it is difficult to tell where this morning's M-class flare originated. We have sunspots 1280, 1281, 1282, 1283, 1277 left over, and 1287. And they're all over the sun, high and low latitude. The Solar Dynamics Observatory is flowing enough data to keep a whole floor of data analysts busy crunching it. Nobody really knows which one is responsible or what's going to happen in the next 24 hours. The sun is more active now than in the last 25 years, perhaps more than that. Although the blast site was not directly facing Earth, radiation from the explosion nevertheless ionized Earth's upper atmosphere. Now that means that very, very fast radiation came in. This would be photons, not particles, that came to the Earth from the sun. This altered the propagation of radio signals around Europe, where it was high noon at the time of the flare. The cloud, that is the proton bunch of particles that was launched out into space, will miss Earth. And so it's no danger of an aurora or a geomagnetic storm this time. But I got to tell you, all solar chambers are locked and loaded. And the power grid is in the crosshairs. The question is not if we will be hit by a solar storm large enough to shut down the power, but how long it will be until it happens. My colleague Michio Kaku is out there as often as the budget will allow him to do so, trying to get people to listen to perhaps an oversight of the astrophysics community, that these solar flares, like the one we had in 1829, could be rather devastating. And I don't mean on a temporary basis. I mean actually melting down the cores of these large transformers that step down this large voltage to your local voltage that comes in and runs your stuff. Once those large transformers go down, there's no replacing them for a while. There's none in inventory, I can tell you that. They're big-ticket items. And everybody has reduced their inventories to the absolute minimum because that's the way, you know, business is done these days. The tax structure is such that you just can't afford to hold on to inventory. The quality systems that are set up these days drive you to keep those inventories as low as possible. And you know, that's just something we live with economically. So I suggest that you visit one of the many sites out there selling survival food and food storage and good gear and get prepared. Of course, you can always visit our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com and pick up the basics fast and well packaged. And by basics, I mean an emergency radio, water, a little bit of dehydrated food, emergency kit. Because I could tell you, when this stuff hits, and we're down here in it, I mean, Lee came, took us by surprise. Everybody was looking over on the East Coast at you know, the hurricane Irene that came in and caused so much havoc in the Northeast. And it was sort of like a sleight of hand. 24 hours later, boom, there's this big tropical storm right on our doorstep. And it came in Friday afternoon, and it's just been dumping rain. It's dumped about 11 inches so far in this area. Of course, the area needed it, and I got to tell you, it didn't come in such a way that, you know, it was an inch an hour or so. It's just been a long – some of it's been pretty good winds, 45 miles an hour, but the rest has been pretty gentle, and it's been a pretty good rain. Now, that's heading right up the eastern side of a cold front that's coming in from the northwest, and unfortunately, it's going to drive it, you know, east of the Mississippi and north back to Virginia, so – you guys, you know, get ready with the baler because more is coming. By the way, when you check out from 1-800-PREPARE.com, add my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, as your checkout, and you'll get an additional 10% off. Could be helpful to you. We have a wide-ranging program tonight. My phone numbers, if you want to get a hold of us anywhere toll-free in North America, 888-429-5471. I'm going to need a lot of listener participation tonight because the topics we're talking about demand it. I'm getting conflicting stories in the news. It depends on what reporter you read. It depends on what agency you listen to. And I would like to have the street version. I would like to have your version. So please participate tonight, 888-429-5471. Also, if you're outside the country or if you're off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us. It's 530-413-4511, and that will roll over to all the lines. If you are wanting to walk around the mall tonight or the beach or go roller skating or whatever and have that sly smile of informative nature on your face, you can listen to us by cell phone through your Bluetooth. How about that? 760-569-7676. 760-569-7676. Then put in the passcode 192-919. 192-919 and then pound. And you'll be listening to the program. You won't be able to talk back to us because it's kind of a one-way conference line, but at least you can listen to the program live. If you're listening archives, pay close attention. Rewind often because there's some excellent information in this here tonight. So we'll get started in about 1 minute 20 seconds. We'll be back with X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Fasten your seatbelt. Here we go. As you know, we often talk about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. And I've got to tell you, one of the greatest mysteries out there right now is just on every channel everywhere. Is what's going on with the job situation? I mean, we used to say, come on, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out. But hey, maybe it does take a rocket scientist. I don't know. Do we have any rocket scientists running for president right now? In fact, does the president have anything to do with getting jobs going? What is the mystery? This is really a mystery. I'm telling you, you got the best minds in the country just racking their brains trying to figure out how to get this going. They're throwing money at it. They're threatening people. They got all the agencies out there telling people you got to start spending money. Get out to the malls. Come on, people. It's not working. None of the old-time, short-term, buy whiskey and get people to the polls kind of tactic is working right now. And you know there's a shortage of jobs. Well, there is. But if you really want a field that is sure to have plenty of openings for the next 10 years, why don't you try the junk business? No, I'm not talking about Fred Sanford junk, okay? we wouldn't talk about that on this program anyway, because that's not the nature. We're going to get mysterious here. A small fleet of net-flinging spacecraft could clear every piece of space junk out of low Earth orbit within a dozen years, according to a researcher working on the concept. Now, that is a jobs program, if I ever heard one. Come on, people. There are at least 2,500 pieces of junk up there made of titanium and gold and aircraft aluminum, all kinds of high-priced stuff. Imagine what that stuff would bring at Storage Wars. Just, I mean, unbelievable collector's item stuff. Each spacecraft, known as an electrodynamic debris eliminator, otherwise known as EDI, you got to love these space guys, because it's like they must eat alphabet soup for lunch, you know, because it's like, hey, I got EDDE in my soup. What can we make out? I know, electrodynamic debris eliminator. Yeah, I like it. Jeez. Anyway, it would capture orbital debris in a net and then drag the junk down out of harm's way, meaning drop it into the upper atmosphere and let it burn up as it goes into reentry. Come on, this stuff's generally weightless. I mean, yes, it's traveling at 18,000 miles an hour, but their orbit's pretty darn stable. It could take 100 years for some of these orbits to decay. All they really need is one good karate kick, and they're going to be heading down into the atmosphere and strike the atmosphere at about 18,000 miles an hour, and they'll burn up like a daisy smack with a 9-iron. The eddies would draw their power from the sun and from Earth's magnetic field rather than rely on costly chemical repellents or propellants, helping keep costs down, said Jerome Pearson, president of, and I love the name of this company. You guys got to look it up. Send them your job application now. Got it? Here it is. President of Star Technology and Research, Inc. No, there's no kind of acronym that goes with it. It's Star Technology and Research, Inc. He says, we're coming to the point where we have a design for a vehicle which could be very, very useful, Pearson said during a presentation with NASA's Future in Space Operations Working Group on Wednesday of this last week. He says, in a dozen years, we could get rid of all the old rocket bodies and all the old spacecraft. Well, guys, I think that's just the junk opportunity of the millennia. We're talking about a bunch of eggheads that get together and say, how are we going to nudge this stuff out of space? What are we going to put up there that leaves the good stuff alone and only goes back after the old rock? Do you know what one of those old rocket bodies would bring at a junkyard? My goodness. And, you know, plus it would clean up space. I mean, it's a great idea. And it just wouldn't take that much. You know, in the 80s, there was a television program. It had, Andy of Mayberry was in it, right? And it was called Salvage One. And, you know, this was, you know, kind of a retired, maybe rift astronaut who owned a junkyard and built his own, you know, backyard spacecraft, a reusable craft called Salvage One. And it had cool stuff in it. You know, it had like, you know, automatic transmission shifter and, you know, small block Chevy, I'm sure, for one of the water pumps, whatever. Anyway, it was kind of a cool series. I think it only lasted one or maybe two series. It didn't do as well as Lost in Space. But then when Lost in Space came out, it was pretty cool. By the time Salvage One came out, we were already lost in space. So we already did that, been there. So we needed something more. You know, we were satiated with that. Some junkyard space salvage ship wasn't really exciting to us anymore. But now we have a real business out there. We got to go clean up NASA's mess, because sometime 30 or 40 years ago, somebody at the National Aeronautic Space Administration said, oh, don't worry about it. There's so much space up there. We'll never junk it up. One tin can here and there is not going to make any difference at all. Come on, guys. A litter bug is a litter bug is a litter bug. Eventually, somebody has to go take out the trash. So Eddie's services may be sorely needed. Now, The question is, can you put up an automated, like, thing that's going to be up there like Spider-Man, just snagging stuff it gets close to, putting up, like, a giant ball of extension cords? That's what I would do if I were them. No, extension cords, you know, like you plug into the wall and run out to the saw in the backyard so you can cut up shelf wood. Because it gets snagged on everything. I mean, come on, if you jump out of an airplane, don't take a parachute. Take an extension cord. It's going to hang up on something. That's what I would do. Just extension cords, old extend. You don't even have to have the end on them. Just throw them out the back door. They'll hang up on something. Anyway, you got this hairball flying around in orbit, snagging little bits of junk, some of it the size of a baseball, others the size of a trash can from the backyard, or a big piece of sewer pipe. And like I said, just giving it that little nudge, just a little correction in its orbital path, orbital path, and head it toward the atmosphere. Let it start slowing down, heating up, burning up. That's going to be a great light show. Will it work automated? You know, a new report warns that there's already so much junk in space that humanity may have reached a tipping point in which collisions could start to increase exponentially, spawning more and more space junk. You know, it's kind of like a traffic accident waiting to happen, except, you know, there's no DOT there to sweep the glass up. Everything that gets busted up makes more pieces. And then we're really going to have a mess. I mean, come on, we need a space Swiffer. And all you guys out there that are out of work, we're only talking about 200 miles to go up into space. That's it. It's 200 miles. That's like from Atlanta to Louisville. It's nothing. I mean, we could get there easily. There's lots of ways to get there. Well, okay, let's toss some out. Give us a call. Hold on a second here. I think we've got somebody on the line here. We may have an inventor. No, we don't. Let's see. Have somebody else that writes in. Do you want to know the truth about jobs? When government got involved, industry went south, and there went the jobs. Oh, and after it went south, then it went east, way east, far east. Well, that may be part of it, but, you know, it didn't start there. Like all the textile mills, they started in Boston. Yeah, in Boston. The cotton was grown in the South for sure. But we didn't have mills down here. The mills were in Boston. The old buildings are still there. Of course, they're all like comedy clubs and lawyer offices now. And actually, it's kind of hard to tell the difference between the two. But that's how it went. I mean, when industry left the North and came to the South because of cheaper labor rates, they had job wars up there too. It was horrible. And then, you know, 18, 19 years ago when they started figuring out, you know, gee, we need to take this stuff to China. We need to take it to India. We got to go to Malaysia and start sewing this thing on it. Because we got this guy, Sam Walton, and he's putting this national chain of stores together, and he's driving the price down so low, we can't make any money. I mean, come on. America wants to buy an $8 shirt, $5 if they can get it. Well, we can't do that in America. We got to make it over there. And I got to tell you, people, long as you keep going in there and buying $5 shirts, there's not going to be any mills here in the U.S. That's where the jobs went. That's where the jobs went. You know, I found it so hilarious in the news today. Hundreds of thousands of people went protesting in Israel to protest price increases. I had to slap myself in the forehead. Because I said, what do you mean price increases? Who controls price increases? That's right. You control price increases. You do. If you stop buying, it stops selling. You determine the price. It is supply and demand. If you demand it, the price is going to go up. If you don't demand it, or if you demand it slowly, the price is going to go down. That's the way it goes. That's supply and demand. It's simple capitalism. You can't keep prices low if there's a good profit to be made, especially not in Israel. That doesn't take a rocket scientist. Come on. But I'm talking about a real jobs program here. This is something that could be global. It could be anywhere. The closer to the equator, the better, because that's where most of the junk is launched from. Because the velocity of the Earth is faster, okay? Because it's larger, you know, in diameter relative to the spin of the Earth. And you get to take advantage of all that rotational speed, and you can get out into space a little quicker. So French Guiana is the favorite place. I mean, we have a launch a day just about down there. Anyway, space junk is a real problem. You know, it's worse than I-65 between Louisville and north of there. It's horrible. And we're not talking about beer cans and old McDonald's bags. We're talking about chunks of aluminum, chunks of titanium, gold, platinum, precious metals, like unbelievable. And all that stuff is in the way. We've junked up space. Can you believe it? Of course you can believe it. That's how you find habitable planets. That's how you find out if there's life out there or not. Just look for the junk in orbit. You'll be able to tell right away if somebody lives there or not. Because we crap where we eat. We're humans. Well, we're getting smarter about it, I got to say. We're getting a lot cleaner about it. But these pieces of space junk, which may be defunct spacecraft, they might be abandoned launch vehicles or fragments from satellite collisions. Yes, they're up there banging into each other. And they zip around the Earth pretty darn fast, about 28,000 kilometers per hour. That's about 17,000 or so miles per hour. That's so fast that even tiny little paint flecks can damage a spacecraft. You know, look what a .22 caliber bullet does. It's just a little tiny 40-grain bullet. But at 1,100 feet a second, they're pretty hard to catch in your hand. They got to slow down a lot. There's a lot of energy at 17,500 miles an hour in a grain of salt. And there's a lot of this stuff. Much of it is larger and far more dangerous than paint flecks. We're talking about canisters, tools, connectors, hoses, all kinds of stuff that breaks off or is jettisoned from spacecraft as they break apart and go into space. NASA estimates that Earth's orbital debris cloud contains more than, get this, 20,000 pieces as big as a softball, and more than 500,000 pieces bigger than a marble. You think we can clean that up in 12 years? There's no way. So I want you out there to get the creative juices going, and I would love to hear your ideas. Come on, what is your salvage one idea for getting rid of space junk? 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471, anywhere in this country. I know you didn't get the memo. I didn't either. Somehow I made it into my spam folder or something. Or I know, maybe they didn't send me one. But I didn't get to go to that workshop. I wasn't in the idea with all those guys sitting around the room going, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this? I think my extension cord idea is a really good idea. Extension cords are cheap. You know, you can find one around any construction site. They don't have to be new. They could even have a few existing knots in them or nicks in them. You know, they don't have to be $500,000 extension cords, anything. Or how about a fishing reel? Anybody ever go fishing? Anybody ever cast a fishing rod? Then you know what I'm talking about. That little rat's nest of nylon filament, monofilament that you're supposed to cast through the little eyelets with the weight on the end or the bobber or the lure out into the water. It doesn't work. Well, it does with a you know, spinning reel or an open face reel, but the actual spooling reel, there's kind of an art. You got to drag your thumb on it or something because it gets going so fast that when the line slows down, the spool keeps going. And a rat couldn't make a nest more disorganized than that reel. You just got to go at it with a pair of scissors and start over again. Yeah, I mean, for bottom fishing where you're just kind of dropping it to the bottom, yes. But I had a friend in high school that could actually cast the beggars and keep it from tangling up. Look, too much skill is required, but it would be perfect for catching space junk. I'm telling you, just a bunch of pen 520s out there, put them out into space, put little solar parachutes on them, cast them out in every different direction. You'd have the biggest mess of space junk you ever saw. Yeah. And then it would just slow down, fall into the atmosphere, and there you go. And I think it could be done. All this could be done unmanned. There's enough C2 rocket engines out there to get it done. All right. Alex writes in and says, okay, I got a design for a space Zwiffer that doesn't need to launch. It just flies. I like it. I like it. Come on. All we got to do is get this stuff to fly fast enough. Or if you've got, just get out your anti-gravity paint, you know, like Journey to the Center of the Moon or Journey to the Moon, paint it up and let it go. It's going to hang up on something out there. Or something like Silly String. You remember that stuff? You know, the Tom Hanks Silly String sneeze and big. It was awesome. It was awesome. I've done it 10 times myself, and it got tremendous laughs every time. Caution, though, never shoot Silly String at the birthday cake when the candles are lit. The darn stuff's flammable. It'll climb right back up that stuff and catch on fire. So don't spray it on anybody either that's fixing to blow the candles out. Fixing to, as in preparing to. Okay, that's the way we say it in the South down here. We're just 40 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico, so I can use that word on radio. Anyway, there's lots of good ideas, and I like them all. I like the aerosol polymer idea. Just take it out of space, blow up an M80 and the darn stuff. You got a huge cloud of sticky, gooey, nasty, fluorescent orange goo floating through space, and you're snagging stuff right and left. And all you got to be is just slightly slower than that stuff. You don't have to actually catch up with it. It's going 17,500 miles an hour. It'll change it or something. All right, let's see. He says, Cavorite laminate. Hey, well, I like that too, if you've ever used that stuff. It's used for attaching formica to particle board. It works. It works. It's affectionately called booger glue. It works. It gets on everything. Trust me. Ask any mom of a carpenter or wife that's tried to get booger glue out of a pair of jeans. It ain't coming. You can stretch it out in space and it'll catch stuff. I mean, use your head, people. We could stretch out giant strings of duct tape. That's getting your ducks in a row, isn't it? Ha! No, come on. That's a pun. We don't do puns on X Squared Radio. Anyway, those numbers are only going to keep growing as humanity lofts more payloads and the pieces already up there collide with each other. In 2009, for example, a defunct Russian satellite and a U.S. Iridium communications satellite slammed into each other, adding at least 2,000 pieces of space junk to the total. That's enough to ruin your day and your bank book. NASA and other organizations are trying to keep track of all this stuff, but the problem is getting so bad that many experts are calling for active intervention, a la entrepreneurship. You could do it. To safeguard space assets and astronauts, I say the United States and other nations need to start pulling some of the debris out of the sky. Well, my question is, if you're going to send unmanned stuff up there, how do you know whether you're snagging good stuff or bad stuff? How do you know it's junk? Like, you don't want to go up there and, like, snag the Hubble telescope, right? Because that would be the good stuff. What you want to do is snag all those old Russian and Chinese satellites. In fact, snagging all the Russian and Chinese satellites out of the air wouldn't be a bad idea. I just think it could be done, and it could be done very cheaply. It could. There's lots of empty plants around the country. There's lots of ways to launch stuff up there. You could use compressed natural gas and liquid oxygen. There's lots of ways to get a rocket up there. 200 miles. It's nothing. We could do it. Anyway, that's where Eddie comes in, according to Pearson. It has the potential to make a big difference in Leo, which houses many critical assets, including the International Space Station. That's low Earth orbit. Leo. Come on, we're talking about NASA guys, right? They use these acronyms all the time. Probably have one for, hey, let's go get a beer. What is it? Oh, never mind. Small-scale removal won't really make a difference, Pearson said. We need wholesale removal of low Earth orbit debris to significantly reduce the risk. Uh-huh. Mr. Pearson, how much is it worth to you? Come on, put a price on it, and let's turn American entrepreneurship loose on it. I don't want to have a big jobs program. I don't want to have a big highway program. We're going to put, you know, 40,000 people to work fixing asphalt all over the country. Come on, when those jobs are over, they're over. And what do you got? You got less potholes in the roads? I think we could go a little bit longer on the roads we have. Just fill them in and keep going. This space junk, that's a real opportunity. That's a real opportunity for an entrepreneur. Each Eddie spacecraft is essentially a series of nano satellites connected by a very long piece of electrically conducting tape. Did I not tell you duct tape would work? Up to 2 miles or so in length. Solar arrays are dotted along the tape's length. At each end of the Eddie sits a net manager packed with nets, each of which expands to the size of a house when deployed. The entire Eddie spacecraft weighs just 220 pounds, Pearson said. Sounds like they have the idea all figured out, but I think we could beat them to the punch. As Eddie moves through Earth's magnetic field, a voltage is generated along the length of the conducting tape. That's called the dynamo effect. You remember the dynamo experiment where we let out a tether behind the space shuttle and we were going to measure how much voltage was in the upper atmosphere as the space shuttle sort of dragged it along in the road behind it? Boy, did they get a surprise. It exploded the tether. There's a lot of voltage from the dynamo effect at that speed. This voltage drives a current which operators use to push Eddie through space. It can move in pretty much any direction using this low-thrust propulsion system. Are we talking about zero-point energy here? Surely not. He says, what we do is we change the angle of our conductor with respect to the magnetic field so we get a force in the direction we need to go to change our orbit, Pearson said. We're sailing on the magnetic wind. What? Has that been invented yet? Did he just let out a national secret? Boy. You're saying that we could sail anywhere we want around the Earth just by surfing the magnetic waves? Far out. An eddy would sail right up to a big piece of debris, a defunct satellite, say, and snare the object in one of its many nets. Then eddy would drag the junk down to a lower orbit, which would soon decay. The junk would burn up in Earth's atmosphere, and Eddie would move on to its next target. The concept would only work up to about 1,200 miles altitude or so, Pearson said, because Earth's magnetic field drops off rapidly, actually the square of the distance, so Eddies would be restricted to low Earth orbits, unable to tackle junk in higher orbits. Gosh, if we could clean out everything within 1,200 miles of Earth, I think it'd be pretty smooth sailing. Especially for the International Space Station, which we hope we don't have to abandon because the latest Russian mission up there to change out people and drop off another ton of food, unfortunately, catoed. Yeah, catastrophic failure before it got out of the atmosphere. Low Earth orbit is cluttered with about 2,500 objects bigger than a softball. The debris would weigh about 2,000 tons here on Earth. A fleet of 12 eddies, once aloft, could deorbit nearly all this space junk within 7 years, Pearson said. He thinks the first full-scale operational Eddy could be launched within 5 years, so that means low Earth orbit could be swept clean of large object by 2023 or so. Now, here's the price tag, people. Here's what's on the table. The price for getting this done, 12 satellites, 12 machines, 12 duct tape launchers. You ready? Hold on. Here it is. Not counting budget overruns, the price for getting this done would run about $84 million per year over the next 12 years, Pearson said. Since space debris is a global problem, that cost could be shared among a number of nations, he added. There are some potentially tricky legal issues to work out, however. Under the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the country that builds and launches an object owns it and is responsible for it indefinitely. So an American-built Eddy couldn't deorbit a defunct Russian or Chinese satellite without getting permission first. Oops, we took out a fully operational Russian satellite with our duct tape launcher. Sorry, everyone. Our problem. Big mistake. Sorry about that. By the way, the optics on this baby, really nice. Pearson said Eddy would likely start by removing American space debris, like it can tell the difference. But the ultimate goal is to sign agreements with other nations allowing Eddy to take the debris and the responsibility for it off their hands. Yep. Well, I can see with 2,500 small objects out there, 2,000 tons of debris, 12 years. Hey, accidents happen. We're so sorry that a highly secret satellite you had up there with all those listening capabilities, well, it kind of got tangled up in our extension cord launcher. Yeah, sorry about that. Launched by a couple of boys down in Arkansas. They didn't really know what they were doing. But, hey, we paid them $5 million. They did it for half the price, and we got the job done. If we can get agreements like that, then that should open the way for removing debris, no matter who put it up there originally, Pearson said. While the Eddy concept is already pretty well developed, it needs some more funding to become a reality, Pearson said. But he's confident it will come through because they're holding NASA hostage. No, he says, I think we're on the verge of getting funded. I like the hostage part. It fits. It fits. Alex writes, just imagine if that regular Joes do this, we could get back to the moon before NASA ever does and get off to Mars just on tech developed in the space junk industry. Pearson's a moron if he has to spend that much to launch that machine. Yep, I'd say moron than off, but he's definitely going to end up with a new house out of that one and a little red Corvette to boot and maybe a private plane. And if he makes a mistake and snags the wrong thing or he makes a big snowball, you know, like an avalanche, we could have a real problem on our hands. Something that's the size of a baseball, not a problem. Something that's the size of a metro bus, now we got a problem. It won't burn up too cleanly. It'll form a nice big molten ball of metal that just might survive all the way to the surface. Yep, might have to come up with a better idea on that. Kind of like the idea of a steerable Zwiffer, though. It makes a good idea. And also is a plausible deniability for the NSA. By the way, while you're sweeping the streets over there, there's an address we want you to take care of. And we also want you to take the blame, and we want you to make the public statements about it. But we still want you to take that satellite out. Oh, I can just see it. I mean, what happens if the Russians put up a space junk sweeper? Huh? How are we going to react to that? Oh, no, wait. You can't do that because, you know, we have to monitor what you're cleaning up there. Some of that stuff might not be junk. We can't let the Chinese put a space Zwiffer up there. No, we can't do that. Yeah, as Alex says, that's a big, fat lawsuit. Yeah, maybe so. so what? We got courtrooms too. We got lawyers too. So Mr. Pearson spends a couple of years in jail. Big deal. The satellite's gone. Yeah, figure it out. Well, interesting subject. You know, I was a teacher assistant when I was in the eighth grade. No, I didn't just erase the board. I actually helped teach younger students. And it was kind of, I don't know, train the trainer program or something like that. But anyway, it was a good program, and it gave me something to do with my spare time, and was good and talented at it, I guess, teaching kids mathematics that were younger than I was. They learn better from kids than they do teachers sometimes. It's a peer thing. But anyway, the three or four of us that were involved in this were interviewed by the local paper. And the question that she asked me, because I think the interviewer was kind of wondering whether I wanted to be a teacher or not. Yeah, as if. Anyway, she said, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" I didn't even hesitate. I promise I did not hesitate. I quote, "I want to be an asteroid miner." She didn't know where to go with that. That's for sure. No, seriously. Come on. Asteroids. One asteroid, solid platinum or solid aluminum or titanium. Or how about that diamond planet we talked about last week? Okay, it's 4,000 light years out there. But still, if there's a big one, there's probably a small one. And don't forget, just 250,000 miles away, that's just a few laps around the Earth. Some of you have more frequent flyer miles than that. Just 250,000 miles away is a never-ending supply of H3 and titanium. H-hydrogen-3. It's three hydrogen protons linked together. Got to be pretty cool to do it. But it's a great fuel. And you got oxygen and water locked in the soil of the moon. And you got all these nice, neat, well-made lava vents that go thousands and thousands of feet into the moon. They're perfectly formed, all dormant. And all we have to do is slide into one of those, build a door over it, and make oxygen. It could be done. A few weekends, we could have it done. And it would be self-supporting, by the way. Talk about heavy lift. You make four or five light trips up there and start making your own stuff, and then you've got heavy lift capabilities at 1/6 the gravity and no atmosphere. Sweet. The moon makes a perfect place for a base. Perfect. It only has slightly less atmosphere than Everest. Okay, maybe a lot less than Everest. But still, once you're underground, once you're set up, then you've got all that thermal activity of the moon to keep you warm. You got water. You got power. You got everything you need. You got tons of solar power you can get all the time. Just trying to get those creative juices going. Because, you know, when the tough get going, well, sometimes they sit down and despair. But they don't despair for very long, not in America. Right now we have unemployment rates that are, in most cases, below that of the Depression of 1929. I say that because the Depression, the jobless rate during the Depression, affected the cities. It affected the mega cities like Chicago and New York. It affected them because those people didn't have a way to provide for themselves. They didn't have land to grow a garden in. They didn't have a place to get water. The shelter they had were tenements and flats and apartments that had to be paid for, expensive real estate. And there were no jobs. There was no way out of town. Those people had to be fed. They had to have health care. And so they made up jobs for them. But in the rural areas, like eastern Kentucky and Louisiana and southern Mississippi, the Depression didn't affect this area. You know why? Because people were agrarian. They worked farms. They had horses. They had pigs. They grew corn. They logged. They had natural resources out the wazoo. They grew cotton. They did stuff, and they could take care of each other, not because they were low in population density, but because they knew how to do stuff. They knew how to take care of each other. They could work for 25 cents a day and all the potatoes you could carry home. They would trade stamps, ration stamps back and forth, sugar for shoes and things like that. They didn't drive cars. They rode horses, or they took wagons or trains or buses. It worked out. In the country, they didn't even know what unemployment meant. In the city is where it hit. The reason that it's worse off now is because the rural areas, the places like eastern Kentucky and Arkansas and the rural areas of New York even, they're suffering unemployment far worse than they did during the Depression. We have industry that has moved out into these rural areas. They've built little industrial parks. They've built little factories. They've built little processing areas and refineries and all kinds of pre-production areas that hire high-density people, 40 people, 50 people, a couple hundred people at a building. Those jobs left. Those mega corporations consolidated their organizations into smaller locations. They moved the high-cost operations first to China, and then the quality was so bad that they ended up moving it to Vietnam, and the quality is much, much better. Just a much higher quality technology and a much higher quality workmanship there. And we have companies that are global corporations. They're not American owned anymore. They're mostly owned by foreign money. Those jobs went elsewhere, because those countries need work. And the stuff that's on the consumer end is made somewhere else. For instance, about 50 to 60% of the solar panels that are made in the world are made in China. But they only buy 5% of the solar panels. We buy them. Europe buys them. They're smart. They're making the stuff that the rest of the world is using. But it's kind of uncharacteristic for China, because China normally takes a longer range view of things. Do you know what's going to happen to the United States and Europe as they add solar panels and wind power and more hydroelectric power and thermal power to their mix? That's right. Less and less dependence upon fossil fuels. Well, what we used to call fossil fuels, upon petroleum products. For fuel, less and less we'll be using coal. More and more we're going to be using wind and solar and geothermal. And the solar is getting more and more efficient. Unfortunately, right now all those chips are made in China where it's cheap. But it won't take long. It won't take long for that technology to make a jump. And you're going to start seeing U.S. companies put this stuff together. Now, in the news, really quick as we top up this hour, we had Solyndria. That's a company out in California that was making a solar technology. It's a tube of solar cells, kind of a unique design. And I believe it was pretty efficient. I don't think it's as efficient as some of the non-glass products. But they were selling, and they had a superior product. They did get a low-interest loan and a guarantee from the federal government. I think it was $550 million. It's a lot of money. But it takes a lot to set up manufacturing in the United States. Unfortunately, what you read in the press may not be the whole story. That $550 million might have been the loan guarantee. That's fine. It doesn't mean that they got the loan. It doesn't mean they got the loan. You still have to go to a bank and borrow the money. You still have to go to the bank and borrow the money. You still have to qualify for the loan. That's part of the deal. Same with the ATVM. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, because that's even more corrupt boondoggle. The truth is that Solyndria never got all the money. The money came so slow, and it came loaded with so many government regulations. It didn't match their cash flow. They couldn't build the product and sell it fast enough in order to beat the debt engine. And the loans came due, and they couldn't make the payments, and they went bankrupt. It wasn't Solyndria that went bankrupt. It was the Department of Energy that made them go bankrupt. That's exactly what happened. That's the whole story. That's what you really need to hear. So we are innovative. We come up with the good ideas. And believe me, industry after industry after industry, we see the research and development done here. We see the patent filed here. We see the manufacturing become absolutely impossible. Impossible. Because of government regulations, the Environmental Protection Agency acting as a confiscatory tax and unbelievable confiscatory group of, I don't even know what you want to call them, enforcers that go out there and literally beat these companies into submission. You don't realize the regulation that we're talking about. We're talking about labeling, just labels that can cost a company $1 million just to develop the data to produce the label. And it's not the money. Honestly, it's not. We'd spend the money to get it done. It's the time. We're sorry, but there's only one testing lab in the entire country. And it's backed up for 4 months. So pay in advance. Wait for 4 months. Bring your product up. We'll test it. Give you the data. And 90 days later, you can have your label. Once you have the label, then you can sell it to the customers that want your product. Hello? Hello? That's 7 months later than the money is needed. 7 months later than the sales are required. And that's what's happening in America. That is why we have unemployment the way we do. Because that company, what they're going to do is they're going to pull up stakes. They're going to take their design to China where no such regulations exist. And I'm not talking about regulations that have anything to do with clean air. Far from it. They only have something to do with lining the EPA's walls with cash. That's all it has to do with. Everybody knows it. From top to bottom, they know it. And yet the government that's in charge lets it stay in place. That's the death of America. We want to go to work. We have sales. We have great ideas. We can't build them because we can't get past the regulations. Stupid regulations. One simple label that could be done in a weekend with $40 worth of ink. But no, can't do it. It has to go through the EPA. And department after agency after bureau, it is the same in this country. One pile of sticky red tape after another. And what do? We look the other way. We look the other way. This is what the candidates should be talking about. This is the future of America. And I don't know what to do about it except tell you people, you hear the energy in my voice. It's because we're in the mix. We're in it right now. We're doing it. It's happening right around us as we go. One thing after another, it is taking us on and taking us down. And while the bureaus and agencies and departments are making a fortune, millions and billions and trillions off the American people, nothing, nothing is getting done. That's where we are. So we'll be back right after this. Don't go away, my friends. There's more to come. Right after this message, we'll listen to a little after the gold rush.
Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun. That was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature. century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from southern Mississippi, just above the Gulf of Mexico. Our AccuWindow forecast is tornado. Yeah, exactly. So if you hear the siren going off right before this internet connection ends, you'll know what happened. No, not that. I mean, I'm going to drop the headphones and I'm running, okay? We've been at the inside of Tropical Storm Lee for the last couple of days. And there's no nervousness in my voice at all, because I know you're out there watching over me. By the way, I did say that the candidates need to be talking about those issues. There is one candidate that is doing that, and that's Ron Paul. Now, I do hear people say, oh, Ron Paul doesn't stand a chance of a chocolate ice cream cone in a Mississippi summer. He does, if you care. If you care about America, you will put politics aside, and you can choose a new America. You don't have to take the one they're shoving down our throats. It's our country. We'll run it our way. Now, that doesn't mean that you can follow the way of, I can't really find out who said this. If it was Tyler or if it was Herodotus. Herodotus lived in the 4th century B.C. It is the death of any democracy when the public can vote for itself a piece of the treasury. Well, that's exactly what's going on in America right now. That's exactly what went on in Greece. In Greece, the public voted for themselves such a large piece of the national treasury, they went broke. So they put austerity measures in place. Austerity, it means taking away your allowance so that we can pay the light bill. Austerity. The people threw a fit. They burned cars. They broke windows. They said, woe is me. No more retirement age at 50. Come on. I can't lay on the beach and snag foreign chicks as they come in. No. You're going to have to work, people. The soup line is over. They're having the same thing happen in Israel. Prices going up. They're having the same thing happen in other countries. And the same thing's going on in this country. They call them entitlements. Entitlements. But basically what these are unconstitutional disbursements of wealth to people who didn't earn it. That's right. Now, I'm not talking about people that are sick. I'm not talking about the widows. I'm not talking. That's a very, very, very small fraction of the budget. I'm talking about perfectly healthy, able-bodied Americans that no longer work. They're no longer productive. They are professional consumers. And let me tell you, they are professional voters. A professional voter is someone that's paid to go to the polls and pull a handle. If you're one of them out there, you need to change your ways because you're killing democracy. That's not what it's here for. It never was. So if you have a comment about that, if you think you deserve the check that's coming to you every single month at the cost of the taxpayers, fine. Give me a call, 888-429-5471. Tell me your story. But I'm telling you, this is the science of saving a nation. We're in a pickle. I don't think any one man can fix it. If you read our books, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volumes 1 through 3, and now Volume 4 is out there. And if you read Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, then you know that in this election period, the presidency barely survives. The presidency barely survives. Not because there's no person, male or female, able to take the job and lead. It's because the system is so broken that the executive branch needs to blossom. It needs to blossom. It's no longer a position for one man. The executive branch needs to grow a little bit. We need more brains in that office, more than just one person. We don't need a king. We don't need a czar. We don't need a Führer. We need a few smart people in there that can divide up the labor and get it done. And the system that we have constitutionally was set up to be a president and a cabinet. The cabinet was supposed to be professional advisors, people that had expertise in certain areas that also sided with the president and could advise him. What we have is a system of dukes and earls that work at the behest of the president. They lead departments, agencies, and bureaus with political policies that are edicted from the presidency through those secretaries to those agencies, bureaus, and departments. That's not the way it works, people. That's taxation without representation. That's an unelected body of authority that's disconnected from the legislative process. And it needs to end, and it needs to end in 1 year and 1 month. And there's only one way it can happen, and that's if you make it happen. There is a constitutional way for you to make it happen. Learn about it. Learn about it, and you can make it happen. I want to follow up a little bit on that song we played after the Gold Rush. It was sung by a group of girls, a cappella. It was originally written to guitar. If you know the original artist, yeah, I know the original artist. I got it right here on my iPod. But if you know the original artist, you can call me, 888-429-5471. We'll be back in about 45 seconds. I'll tell you why it's significant tonight. By the way, if you have to leave the computer tonight, you can do so and still listen to the program. Just dial 760-569-7676 and the passcode 192919#, and you can listen on our global conference line. My good friends out in Utah say, reduce the power of government and set the people free. Yeah, well, if the White House has its way, we'll all be working for the government, and then it'll be a simple matter of taking you or taking your paycheck away and giving you a number. Did you know that recently there was a large UFO found on the ocean floor? We actually call those USOs. An ocean exploration team led by Swedish researcher Peter Lindbergh has found what some are suggesting is a crashed flying saucer. Lindbergh's team, which has had success in the past recovering sunken ships and cargo, was using sonar to look for the century-old wreck of a ship that went down carrying several cases of a super rare champagne. Well, you know, there were a lot of investors involved in that expedition. Instead, the team discovered what it claims is a mysterious round object that might or might not be extraterrestrial. It might be superterrestrial. It also might not be crashed. And it might not be uninhabited. I think we have some good ideas out there on that. So if you want to interact with me on this, I'm reading a note that that my studio just sent me. They can Skype also. I forgot to give you guys that. It's BBS Radio 2. BBS Radio, the number 2, if you want to join us through Skype. If you don't want to use your cell phone minutes, you don't have free nights and weekends, you don't want to dial us on your landline, only half of all people in the U.S. actually have a landline anymore, you can Skype us at BBS Radio 2, number 2, and we'll put you through. It's kind of nice, too, because also you can reach me direct. Not call, but you can do what many callers do, and that's send text instant messaging over Skype by reaching us at X2-radio, X2-radio. That's because there's no superscript 2 for X squared, so it's X2-radio. Lindbergh explained to a local media that his crew discovered on the 300-foot deep ocean floor between Finland and Sweden a large circle about 60 feet in diameter. You see a lot of weird stuff in this job, but during my 18 years as a professional, I have never seen anything like this. He says he's been to a two-pie supper and a service station opening. No, I added that. The shape is completely round. Adding to the mystery at the bottom of the Gulf of Bothnia, Lindbergh said he saw evidence of scars or marks distributing the environment nearby, suggesting the object somehow moved across the ocean floor to where his team found it. Dun, dun, dun. It's not clear what to make of this report or the video of the sonar scan that shows the object. By the way, this would be side scan sonar. This isn't the kind of it's not that kind of sonar. No. You lower it with a cable down just about 100 feet off the bottom. Kind of looks like an ice chest, about the size of what you put beer in. And it has a send unit and two receive units. And what it does, it sends out a signal very close to the ground. It bounces back. It's received. It comes up to a cabled receiver on the ship. And they actually take strips about 100 feet wide on the bottom. It's like a isosceles triangle, 100 feet high, goes out at 90 degrees or so, and you get about 100-foot swath of the bottom. Just so happens they ran over this thing, and sure enough, there the image came back. It's actually quite revealing. And I have to tell you, there are no completely round shapes on the bottom of the ocean. Doesn't happen. I've seen the picture of this. 300 feet, that's nothing. We could dive it. You don't even need a bathyscaphe. Not at all. Put a couple tanks on, you could swim down there in less than a minute. You could be there. Well, I would take a little bit longer because you kind of got to get used to the pressure as you go down. But I've scuba dived at almost 300 feet several times. There's nothing to it. Nothing at all. Now, coming up takes a little bit of time. That's why you need two tanks instead of one. But going down, no sweat. a little bit of nitrogen in there, a little bit of helium, you're fine. I would have a man down there with a with an Ever Ready in an hour. No question about it. I'd bring back something. Right. N177. Yeah, okay, not that. But it could be something. It could be something. There might be a doorway. It's not unlike the Russian story I told you a few weeks back of the salvage operator off the Hudson that discovered a flying vehicle down there and was invited in, not unlike the movie The Abyss. This actually was told to me long before the movie The Abyss came out. Some suggest the object is a flying saucer of extraterrestrial origin, and the seafloor scars were dug up when it crashed, although it could have been just motivating along the bottom. You know, by the time you get 300 feet under the water, if you hit that water at any kind of velocity, you're going to come apart like a Hostess cupcake hitting a lunch table during a food fight. But if you're just trying to scoot across the bottom a little bit, you might leave some seafloor scars as you were trying to park that thing. Though, all of the things that might create a round sonar signature that seem to be among the more outlandish. As I said, there are no naturally round things under the ocean. It might be a natural feature formation or possibly a sunken round man-made object like a tank lid or something, like a big oil tank or something that slipped off of a ship. Lindbergh's claim that the object is perfectly round may or may not be accurate, while it looks round from the information so far. The resolution of the sonar image was not high enough to verify that it is indeed round. Like I said, it's only 300 feet of water, two tanks, and an insulated scuba suit, and you're there. And while the lines that appear to be leading to or from the feature may suggest some sort of movement, it is also possible they have nothing to do with the object. Well, that's true. But it's so easily solved, people. Go back out there with the ship. A nice 5/16-inch thick neoprene suit will insulate you plenty well from that water temperature. Send two divers down with a video camera and shoot it. Or if you don't want to send divers down, 300 feet, that's 100 yards. That's nothing. They sell that much cable down at Home Depot. Send a camera down under the ship and shoot some pictures of it. It's not like we're talking 5,000 feet deep. It's not like we're talking high currents or iceberg-infested waters. Let's get it done. Lindbergh himself did not offer an extraterrestrial origin, although he did speculate it might be a new Stonehenge. Now, that could be something that just flooded. This is not the first time a sunken object has been presented as the solution to a mystery. Take, for example, the famous underwater mystery of the Bimini Road, a rock formation in the Caribbean near the Bahamas that resembles a wall or a road. Many New Agers and conspiracy theorists claim the rocks are too perfectly shaped to be natural and either were made by an unknown civilization or are possibly a relic from the lost city of Atlantis. But there we're only talking, 30 to 50 feet underwater? It's nothing. In fact, geologists have identified the blocks as unusually shaped but perfectly natural, weathered beach rock. It's also worth noting that UFOs may not be saucer-shaped. The famous flying saucer description of the first UFOs has since been revealed as a reporting error. Lindbergh said his team has neither the interest nor the resources to further investigate the anomaly. What? You mean those guys that were interested in the champagne are not interested in the story of the millennia? You gotta be kidding me. Deep ocean research is time-consuming and expensive. We're not talking deep ocean research. Not at all. I've pried abalone off almost that deep. Come on. If it's a natural formation, on the other hand, it would probably be a waste of time and money. Yes, yes, yes. Discovery and exploration is always a waste of time and money. I think it's interesting. It's a whole lot less than an expedition to the north above the Arctic in 4,400-meter seas to discover if there's an opening into the inner earth or not. That you could do for a few thousand dollars. Get out there between just off the shore there. I'm sure they have the coordinates marked. I think that's a great myth-busting thing right there. Let's see what it is. Let's go. I'm all in. Give me a call. We'll put the funds together. We'll get it done. Last week we reported on X Squared Radio that Venus had seen a disproportionate number of NASA missions. We reported it. It's true. If you count up the number of missions that have gone out into space, a disproportionate number of them have gone to Venus. Venus is kind of the sister planet to Earth that went wrong. Could be the global warming took it over. Doubt that very seriously. It's a lot closer to the sun than we are. You know, Mercury, Venus, Earth. Many very early men. Remember counting your planets that way? It's a lot closer to the sun and is a lot hotter than the Earth. But they still say that it did at one time have lush green forests and running water. How, I have no idea, unless its orbit changed somehow. But now, this week, a new story has come out we're going to report on. It's called Venus Bias. Oh, it's not what you think. Scientists studying Venus say NASA has a bias against the planet when it comes to scientific missions, and infrequent visits are hindering their research. They're all excited about Venus. They're the closest thing to Venusians you're going to get on this planet, I think. Venus researchers voiced their frustrations at the annual meeting of NASA's Venus Exploration Analysis Group near Washington this week, the journal Nature reported. There hasn't been a U.S. mission to Venus since the Magellan probe radar mapped its surface in the early 1990s, they noted. And NASA recently rejected a number of Venus research proposals. NASA has denied any bias. Well, it could be. You know, they just don't have, they're not just, you know, denying Venus missions. It's not like they roll their eyes, oh, come on. You Venusians again, come on. Mars is the hot subject today. Venus is old news. It's not like that at all. It could be that they're just run out of money. You know, we spend, what, $600 million on NASA each year and $1.3 trillion on national defense. Of course, a lot of that national defense spills over into NASA because a lot of that is satellites and probes and various things that have to go up into space. But we don't put men up there anymore. We have to hitchhike with the Russians. So, I mean, it's been budget cut city since the Apollo missions ended and they laid off some 10 or 15,000 of the smartest people that ever lived. I know this because one of them was my industrial technology instructor in college, former NASA genius, now vastly underemployed in Western Kentucky. And boy, weren't we the benefit of that. Really stimulated our thought processes in a way that I can only begin to describe to you. But since the Apollo mission was eliminated, by the way, Apollo 18, two thumbs down. Yeah, not a big screen movie. Wait for the 2-for-1 video at Blockbuster. Yeah, get it out of the red box. I wouldn't watch it in a theater. Don't waste your money. The Help, though, pretty good. Pretty good. Nice human interest story. Very well acted. Emma Stone, fabulous, fabulous actress. No, she did not play a red-haired ditz this time. Finally gave her a role where she got to express her acting ability, and she really did a great job. Really a great job. I highly recommend the movie. And believe me, it's going to come highly recommended because if you go there, you probably will not sit with the person that you took with you. No, it won't be because she will be crying or he will be crying. It's because the theater will be packed and you won't find two seats together. Go see it. Good movie. Highly recommended. Not really big screen quality, but it's such a good story. You should go support the people who did the film and watch it. Anyway, getting back to what I was talking about, that's part of the jobs problem that we have, is that we have shifted our priorities. Our people are out there rehearsing every week on how to kill other people and how to blow up things instead of how to explore and how to bring more knowledge and wisdom to our planet. These guys want to go to Venus. I think we should give them the money to go. We should just build a few less rockets that kill people and build a few more rockets to go into space and discover things. Their excuse for denying all the Venusian projects was there were just better proposals for other solar system targets. Jim Green, director of planetary science at NASA, said Venus researchers were noticeably upset. Guys, you just got to make Venus sexy. That's all there is to it. That's all there is to it. A lot of us are dismayed, says David Grinspoon. Now, that's a perfect astronomer's name. David Grinspoon, astrobiology curator at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, a co-investigator on several of the proposals. Research grants allocated to Venus studies have made up just 2% of NASA's planetary science funding since 2005. Now, before 2005, oh, it was all Venus all the time. But Mars and quite disappointingly the Moon have been the subject of a lot of research of multiple nations, but not a whole lot of useful data coming back. Although, in the last hour, we're going to cover some discoveries on Mars, and I've got an audio clip that you're going to enjoy very, very much. Wait a minute. Alex writes me. He says, you do know that the militaries of all the major powers of the Earth have extensive submarine base programs that very few have heard of. I have a friend that participated in designing a few of them. Interesting. That's breaking news here on X Squared Radio. We have underwater submarine bases. Had no idea. I had no idea they were shaped like flying saucers, and I had no idea they'd be off the coast of Sweden, or Finland, or in between. Interesting stuff. But I could tell you, during World War II, there was a ton of submarine stuff being done up there, warm water ports for the German army. And it could be something left over from that. Could be something that they had floating or just hanging there under the water, and it got away from them and slipped to the bottom and skidded across the bottom. Could be. Anyway, continuing, without new missions supplying data for research, funding for Venus studies has dwindled, leading to fewer students entering the field, Grinspoon said, which means a smaller group of researchers to lobby for missions. Because of this feedback loop, the community has shrunk, he says. Well, I can understand that. I used to make catalysts for the automotive industry to clean pollutants out of the air. Kind of a nice thing. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I can tell you when I was a junior in high school, was very active in sports. In fact, I was somewhat of a athlete. I won't go any further than that. But oftentimes we had smog alerts. Because we lived up against the San Gabriel Mountains, we got the breezes from L.A., which blew all the smog eastward, up against the mountains. And where did it stop? Right over our high school, which meant we could not go outside and we could not exercise. No laps, no push-ups, no drills. Huge bummer. And now I go back to Los Angeles, and there are a lot more cars now than when I was in high school there. And yet, you can see the air's cleaner. It's definitely cleaner. The old carbureted, non-catalytic converted, non-fuel-injected cars were hogs. 10, 12, 15 miles per gallon. Who cared? Gas was 30 cents a gallon up until Carter became president. Then it kind of went a little crazy. Got up to about 70 cents a gallon, like really quick. We thought we were all going to die, especially if you drive a Roadrunner like I did. And cars polluted. We got traffic jams on the 405, and you had six lanes of traffic on each side of the dividing line, idling along at 20 miles an hour, all belching uncatalyzed carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, hydrocarbons, and nitrous oxides into the atmosphere. Who knew? I mean, we had idle screws on our carburetors, and you adjusted them out until, you know, the car stopped missing at an idle, and then you gave it another turn just to richen it up a little bit and make sure it was running okay. But that was horrible cars. Now you can't even buy a car with a carburetor on it anymore. It has throttle body injection, or it has ported injection or electronic injection. And the fuel management systems are much, much more efficient. Much more efficient. I mean, a 2000 or a 1999 Trans Am raced against a 1969 Trans Am and kicked its bumpers off. It accelerated faster, it stopped faster, it cornered better. It was just a better engine. And nowadays, they're even more efficient. They have Mustangs out there with almost 500 horsepower. They get 35 miles to the gallon. That's pretty incredible technology. And then you have catalytic converters, two, sometimes four of them on a vehicle, in order to get those particulates and hydrocarbons per mile down to the limits that have been set by the government. And it's made cars a lot more expensive, but it's made the air cleaner. It's created a lot more jobs, and it's been good for the atmosphere, I can tell you that. So when you're talking about missions to Venus, you got to talk about exactly the same thing. What's a cost-benefit analysis? What are we going to learn from Venus that will help us here on Earth? Is there something that we could recover from Venus that would help us save this planet? Well, that's good to know. That's what we need to go after. Now, if in this next half hour, by the way, I want to make sure you know the phone line's open, 888-429-5471. We do have a presidential election coming up, as if you didn't already know. We have the Republican candidates beating each other up with giant pillows on the end of sticks. Nobody's getting down and dirty yet. Although I got to tell you that Palin took a swing at several people. In the news, relative to that, you know that there is a multi-billion-dollar fund out there that hasn't been funded. It's called the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Fund. It was designed to be $23.5 billion. Oh, it was a great campaign speech, one of the best. But the program isn't funded. And so Democrats are trying to get that program funded. I'll let you know why in a second. And in their push to get that funded, they're holding up hurricane relief funds. So the press has read, Democrats holding hurricane relief funds hostage for electric cars. That's what the headline reads. I'm going to give you the story behind the story. And here's why I kind of agree with it and why I disagree with it. I agree with it because the Advanced Technology Vehicle Manufacturing Fund of $23.5 billion has not been given to any electric car companies, except two. Well, it's been earmarked to get GM out of bankruptcy. That's beside the point. Tesla and Fisker. You know, Fisker like Whisker with a F. Now, the Fisker story is the tip of the iceberg here. because meetings took place between Mr. Fisker and Vice President Biden, who, as you know, has strong ties in Delaware. So those meetings took place, and then Fisker applied for the funds, even though they didn't meet the criteria of the funding, as far as the final rule goes that was publicized. And lo and behold, here's tens of millions of dollars of low interest or loan guarantees that were given to Fisker. Fisker then immediately turned around, went back to Delaware, and bought the old GM plant in Delaware that's made all kinds of vehicles since the end of the Second World War, out of bankruptcy. They bought the building out of bankruptcy. So what you see, and by the way, gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democrat national campaign. So what you see here is that the low-interest loans went to Fisker. Fisker then went back to the district that Biden met with him about before he got the loans and turned around and gave money to the Democrat national campaign. That's called money laundering, where the taxpayer's money is given to him. He then turns around, writes a check to create jobs and take a piece of old real estate off the books, put it back into private ownership in the exact area of interest of the vice president. That's why the ATVM fund is not going to be funded by the Republicans, because they see it's cronyism. Cronyism is where you pay your buddies all the taxpayers' money, and they turn around and stick a little bit in your back pocket, you know, to help you get through and create jobs and prosperity in your area so you can look like a big hero and get reelected. And lots of them do it. By them, I mean politicians. They will ask for, indirectly, of course, stock in a company to provide a meeting so you can sit down with them and tell your story. Well, the Constitution says that's a big no-no. You should be able to sit down with your representatives whenever there's time. It doesn't mean that you could pull them off the podium and say, hey, I've got a bone to pick with you, or I got a special thing I want to tell you about. It means that when there's time, you can make an appointment, you can go in and sit down with you. You don't have to pay nothing. You should not be required to pay anything. If you feel so moved, you can. But most companies give evenly, 20 here, 20 there, 100 here, 100 there. They don't pick favorites. It doesn't work that way with the ATVM fund. And so I side with the Republicans in this. I don't think the ATVM fund should be funded because of the way it's being used. If it were to be used differently, if it were to be used to actually fund electric car companies building electric cars, then I think it should be funded. But as long as it's going to be used in that fashion, I say kill it. End it. And do it another way. Now, let's talk a little bit about science again. There's a star out there that should not exist. Oh, but it does. It exists. It's just a team of European astronomers has used ESO's Very Large Telescope, also called the VLT. Wow. Don't you love these acronyms? So smart. To track down a star in the Milky Way that many thought was impossible. Well, they were able to find it because they were looking for a specific spectrographic signal. And as the story goes on here, it's going to make a lot more sense to you. They discovered that this star is composed almost entirely of cheese. No, it's composed almost entirely of hydrogen and helium, with only remarkable small amounts of other chemical elements in it. Well, you all know stars are element engines. They crank out oxygen and nitrogen and carbon. But those stars aren't formed from the Big Bang. Those stars are usually formed from later processes and from supernovas, these higher-order elements, multi-proton elements, larger elements, more complex complexes. are made in Afterbang products. The intriguing composition places it in the forbidden zone of a widely accepted theory of star formation, meaning that it should never have come into existence in the first place. Well, the results recently came out in the September 1st issue of Nature. A faint star in the constellation of Leo called, and there will be a test later, so write this down, SDSS J102915 plus 172927 has been found to have the lowest amount of elements heavier than helium, what astronomers call metals, of all stars yet studied. It has a mass smaller than that of the Sun and is probably more than 13 billion years old. That puts it, people, right at the beginning of the universe, which would match what I just told you. Stars, which are element engines, they put out all kinds of stuff, especially if they're post-supernova. It would have to be a very early star. It would have to be a post-Big Bang star. Quote, a widely accepted theory predicts that stars like this, with low mass and extremely low quantities of metals, shouldn't exist because the clouds of material from which they form could never have condensed, said Elisabetta Kaffau. She works for the Zentrum für Astronomie der Universität Heidelberg, Germany, and Observatoire de Paris, France, lead author of the paper. It was surprising to find, for the first time, a star in this forbidden zone, and it means we may have to revisit some of the star formation models. It means we have to rethink the way we thought about stars. Okay, now we got to change everything. Go gather up all the astrophysics books. We have to rewrite them all. Gosh, I love it. The internet, that thing excoriated by those who don't know what a mouse is, comes through again. The team analyzed the properties of the star using the X-Shooter and UVES instruments on the VLT, Very Large Telescope. This allowed them to measure how abundant the various chemical elements were in the star. They found the proportion of metals in SDSS blah, 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 blah is more than 20,000 times smaller than that of the Sun. The star is faint, and so metal poor that we could only detect the signature of one element heavier than helium, calcium, in our first observations, said Piercarlo Bonifacio of the Observatoire de Paris, who supervised the project. We had to ask for additional telescope time from ESO's director general to study the star's light even in more detail, and with a long exposure time to try to find other metals. No luck. Cosmologists believe that the lightest chemical elements, hydrogen and helium, were created shortly after the Big Bang. Gee, that's what I just said. Together with some lithium, while almost all other elements were formed later in the stars. Supernova explosions spread the stellar material into the interstellar medium, making it richer in metals. New stars form from this enriched medium, so they have higher amounts of metals in their composition than the older stars. Therefore, the proportion of metals in a star tells us how old it is. There you go. That's how you rewrite the books, right there. The star we have studied is extremely metal poor, meaning it is very primitive. It could be one of the oldest stars ever found, adds Lorenzo Monaco from Chile, also involved in the study. Also very surprising was the lack of lithium in this star. Such an old star should have a composition similar to that of the universe shortly after the Big Bang, with a few more metals in it. But the team found that the proportion of lithium in the star was at least 50 times less than expected in the material produced by the Big Bang. It's a mystery. how the lithium that formed just after the beginning of the universe was destroyed in this star, Bonifacio added. The researchers also point out that this freakish star is probably not unique. They've identified more of them out there. Well, it's really going to have to change the way we think about stars. And we have all kinds of catalogs on them, and people study them all the time. People spend their whole lifetimes. That's why I don't consider myself an astronomer, because I just don't have the lifetime to spend looking at a handful of stars. I just don't. I mean, I know where a few planets and a few stars are, but I'm an amateur. I'm just a night gazer. These people are the real astronomers. And it's interesting stuff. Almost as interesting as going back to Venus. You know, we're not the only ones that explore space, at least from this planet. The Japanese have had a very aggressive space program, and they went after little smaller targets, something maybe not everybody was going for. But usually when the Japanese put their minds to something, if they've got, especially if they have some Americans on the team to help solve some of the complex problems and come up with the innovative ideas, they do a good job. A space mission to a nearby asteroid launched in 2005 has yielded some interesting clues about Earth's early formation. Now, keep in mind, this was not a mission to another planet. This was a mission to an asteroid. You know, like that eighth grader said to the newspapers. Japanese scientists on that mission report in the journal Science that despite retrieving a very small sample from the nearby Itokawa asteroid, the knowledge gained is huge. This is a great achievement for the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, no acronym, by the way, said Umberto Campins, a professor at the University of Central Florida, an international expert on asteroids and comets. Wow. That would be really cool to have on a business card. The analysis of the Itokawa asteroid sample illustrates the wealth of information that can be obtained even from very small samples and sets the stage nicely for NASA's OSIRIS-REx mission, which is to sample a more primitive asteroid. That asteroid should help us understand the role asteroids played in the origin of Earth's oceans and life. Well, it could be asteroids, it could be broken off pieces of planets with frozen oceans, or liquid oceans floating through space that managed to come crashing into our atmosphere and seeded our oceans with microscopic life. Could be a few tadpoles in the right place. You never know what you're going to get. What scientists found in the Itokawa sample is unequivocal evidence that this type of asteroid is the parent of ordinary chondrites, the most common type of meteorites found on Earth. Space weather morphs asteroid fragments, and when they enter Earth's atmosphere, they burn up as meteors, changing their chemical nature a bit. That's why they are referred to as meteorites, which, by the way, are scattered everywhere. You can go out into the deserts almost anywhere with a metal detector, and you can find them. And how you know they're meteorites is a magnet sticks to them. You can actually pick them up with a magnet. But listen, people, before you do this, I mean, you can sell them for money. They're worth money. You can make a good living at it. But before you do that, get involved with a meteorite club or agency, because what they want to know is, where did you find the meteorite? Take a GPS with you, write down the coordinates, take a photograph of it, and then pick it up. It's really important that you report this stuff so that we can map it and understand how these meteorites hit our planets as kind of clouds or shotgun bursts. It's important. So please record where you find these things when you pick it up. The Japanese's pristine sample has helped distinguish the original material on the rock and how it changed when it entered Earth's atmosphere. That is helpful to understand the origin and evolution of the planet and the solar system. It's important stuff. We learn a lot from this. Now, as we near the last part of the second hour, I don't want to get into this this stuff about Mars until the last hour, because it just needs to be covered contiguously. It's really groundbreaking stuff. Some of it you may already know, but that's what we do here. We connect the dots. We let you know what's going on. We let you know what the significance of it is. We sort of crack it open so that you can see what's on the inside. And that's what we're going to do in this last hour. So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left in this hour. We cover a lot of stuff on X Squared Radio, and the format, as you know, as of January of 2011, we changed a little bit. We don't have guests on as often as before because there's just too much information in too many areas to cover, and getting multiple guests to come on in a single night just doesn't work out that well. So 2 weeks from tonight, we are going to have a special guest. He's come out with an ebook, and I'm going to cover that in 2 weeks with you. And it's really good. And he's been on the program before. The subject matter is leading edge, and I think you're going to enjoy it. He's actually turned it into a novel, because sometimes this information cannot be released in its raw form. It's too revealing. And so they put it into novel form, and you can follow it, and it's going to be interesting, and you'll see when we bring him on. He's excited about his book. Also, this month, a lot of traveling, a lot of changes are going to happen. And, you know, exciting stuff. We're going to bring more and more to it as the weeks go on. What I would like to see is a little more interaction from the listeners. I know we have thousands of people out there listening, because I see the content streaming out Monday morning when people go back to work, although tomorrow's Labor Day, so I doubt that'll happen tomorrow. But we can see from the connections that there are a lot of you out there listening all over the world. And we have been covering a lot of space news and a lot of social science and a lot of political science on this program, trying to cover all sides and not take sides, but keep you informed as to what's going on and who's doing what and what you can do to change things the way you want to change them. That's what this program's about. Everything that goes in goes into the X Squared engine and comes out positive. So we don't take negative shots at anybody. We try not to anyway. Try to throw as much humor into it as I feel comfortable doing. And the feeling that I get from you is that you enjoy it. What I would like to do is get you to call in. So my phone number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. We have a story coming up in the next hour that's quite controversial. It has been covered on other programs. As far as I know, no answer has been found. But this is a new recent announcement that Russia, as you know, is now responsible for transporting all humans into the space station. All manned efforts have to now go through the Russian Federal Space Agency. What you don't know, and has not been put on the news yet, but this is where we feared it might go. It's a natural evolution of losing control of a manned space program. It is a tragedy as far as the United States of America's dream of leading the exploration of space. I have often said on this program, and have for many years before that, that he who controls space controls the world. Not that control of the world is important to us, but it should be important to us that someone else might. Russia may put the space program under the state defense order. Let me repeat that just in case the internet wobbled a little bit. Skype maybe wasn't clear enough or you missed it. Russia may put the space program under state defense order. Now, it's not as though we haven't done that here. I mean, come on. Almost every single person that's gone into space has either been Navy or Air Force. They're all former military. They're all former jet pilots. They're all former military people. And, yeah, I have thought of having Errol Taylor on the program. And we will continue that, the political science subject. There's a lot to this. This is much more than politics. And I'm going to get into it much more in the next hour. But the Russian Federal Space Agency, Roscosmos, said on Wednesday it is considering returning the federal space program to the framework of the State Defense Order to ensure steady financing and reduce the number of accidents with space launches. You know, we announced in the news in the first hour that the space station may have to be abandoned because the shift change that was going to take place was dependent upon this supply ship that was just launched up. And it catered, had a catastrophic failure. Over a ton of food, various supplies and equipment were being delivered. This has, up till now, the Soyuz program has been a very reliable rocket system. It's just a good truck that just keeps going up and going up and going up. Well, now they've had some problems, and now we've just had one fail. Vitaly Davidov, who is with Roscosmos, he's actually the deputy head of it, he says it would be beneficial to return the Federal Space Program and the GLONASS program to the framework of the State Defense Order. Now, I don't know if you know what that means. That would be like NASA falling under the NSA. That'd be like NASA being run by the CIA. I know, as though it isn't already. I got you. But publicly, it is, you know, we set up bleachers and we watch things take off and we emulate our astronauts to the very last man and woman. But generally, it's a secret program. He goes on to say, it would bolster discipline in issues relating to financing, quality control, and scheduling deadlines in manufacturing. Well, I mean, firing squads have a tendency to do that. You know, gulags have a tendency to, you know, tighten up the discipline a little bit. I got you. I'm there with you. Militarizing things can make things more controllable, more accountable. You know, in our country, the NASA program is generally run by grad students, volunteers, people that work for very small salaries, except for the actual heads of the departments or the people that write the grants. They make a pretty good salary. But the vast majority of them are kids. You know, they work NASA as a resume builder. To go on to other things, to work in universities or to work for private industries. NASA's not a career for people. You know, it's just not. You just don't make enough money doing it. It's low budget. But it's also low discipline, you know. But this is a different story. And I'm going to get into it in more detail. Let me do some changes here and take a quick break. Because it's important that you don't miss this. You have to know how far back this goes and what discoveries have been made, because it's important that you see the scope of what this could mean. And the interesting thing is that we have a president that one president says we're going back to the moon. We're scaling up the program. By 2020, we're going to have a base on the moon. The next president comes in and says, no, 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 no. End of manned space program. We're done. We're out of there. We're retiring the space shuttle fleet. Everything is going robotic. If we need to send people up, we'll hitch a ride with the Russians. You're going to find out why in the next hour. We'll be back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming to you after this.
times, so many times, but no reason to talk about.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. The tornado sirens have settled down a little bit down here in southern Mississippi. Looks like we missed another one. Just a little Goodbye Milky Way by Enigma, in case you're wondering what the bumper music was. It's important that we stay creative, we stay tolerant of one another, open minds. I was, after watching the film The Help, realizing that in the 60s, especially the early 60s, we were sort of like a national adolescence. We were temperamental and we were violent and we shot people and we burned things and broke things. And we were generally irresponsible and intolerant as a people. And we watched, you know, great statesmen for freedom, for liberty, for equality. We watched them gunned down before their children. And it was an embarrassing time for this country. And I'm glad we've outgrown it. I think the frustration that we feel now is not for any color of people. And I resent the press and those who are reporting the stress that our society is under right now. I resent them representing it as any kind of racial stress in our country. I deny that. As an American, as an earthling, I think that what we're feeling is the stress and frustration of a people, a class of people who have great ideas and great heart, who have great imaginations. And I think that they're being held back because as they try to put their ideas to make things better, to make things smoother, to make things more efficient, to create, to build, to expand, to provide, they're not being given the access to the capital that they need to get things going. Now, this is not a handout. This is a hand up. This isn't a free ride. It's being invited to the show. And so when we see cars turned over in this country, it isn't because we're not getting our check in the mail. That's not it at all. Americans aren't that way. We don't like a free ride. We don't like a free giveaway program. That's not our style. You know, food stamps for students, I think, is one of the most awesome ideas ever in economy. Because a student that's in school who is married or has a young family, that's the only way you're going to get food stamps. You're not going to get one as a single person. You can go get a job. You can support yourself. You can live off your food card at the university as long as you don't overeat. But if you have a young family and you're taking any classes harder than underwater basket weaving, you're going to have to study. You're going to have to take the time to get good grades. Now, I don't mean D students and C students. I mean, if you're going to get A's, if you're going to go on, you're going to be smart and get that degree, you're going to be a productive member of society, you're going to pay those food stamps back 1,000 times over in taxes throughout your life. We know that. You know that. To say in the press that the food stamp program for students should be eliminated is an absolute buffoonery. These are the people that are doing something. These are the people that are might be working part-time and going to school full-time. These are the people that are sacrificing. These are the people that are doing the job every day of improving themselves. And when they improve themselves, they improve their town. If they improve their town, they improve their state and thus the nation and thus the planet. It's the best money we ever spent. The money we spend on free handouts that goes down the gutter, that is sold on the streets for beer money, that is the program that needs to be fixed. The entitlement system that keeps people on a dole that robs them of their dignity. That's what's destroying this country. Because when you destroy a person's dignity, you destroy the dignity of a town, of a community. It doesn't become a community anymore. The CRP program, paying farmers not to farm. When you divide a farming community by paying people not to farm, you rob them of their dignity. and that land is locked into that program. Their kids cannot farm it, their grandkids cannot farm it, and they can never, ever get out of the program. You've ruined the land. You've ruined the people that live on it and farm it. There has to be a better way. And the government is robbing the people. And if they don't get enough money from the people, they print more. Thus robbing the value of the dollars that people do have. And then they force the world in a different direction. That's the stress that we feel in this country. That's what needs to be alleviated. And the way to alleviate it is to provide a way. I almost use the word give, but it's not the right word. I'm asking government to take its foot off the neck of the people. Let them get up, and they will drag us out of this mess. And if your politicians in your state cannot understand that, fire them. You are the boss. And in 13 months, you have the ability to clean the slate. If we can't find 535 good people in this country, we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble. Don't take the money away from students. They're doing stuff. They're the ones that are improving themselves. But there are perfectly able-bodied Americans that can work and want to work. And we are robbing them of their dignity. And that's the death of this nation. The Russian aerospace industry has faced a series of misfortunes over the last 9 months. Hold on a moment while I reach for a puff, so I have to dry my eyes. In December 2010, a Proton M booster rocket failed to put three GLONASS M satellites into orbit. The launch of the rocket booster rocket carrying a military geodesic satellite GEO-IK-2 ended in failure in February, 3 months later. After the first two mishaps, a number of senior space industry officials were fired, and Roscosmos chief Anatoly Permanov was forced to resign. Well, we don't do that in our country. We promote them, or they go into politics. However, the problems persisted as the aerospace industry failed to manufacture the planned number of spacecraft, and incidents with the launches continued. Well, now that we do also in this country, at least we used to, we had to hit the production numbers even if we were making scrap. And that's usually what happened. As we pushed the manufacturing harder and harder without fixing the problems, we made more and more junk. But it's okay. It's okay. We had a good warranty program. 12 months, 12,000 miles. Oh, yeah. And if you had problems with your car, you can always bring it back to the dealership, of course. And most of the time, well, okay, some of the time, it didn't cost you any money when you brought that car back. And if you got a lemon, oh, well, buyer beware. And then the Japanese came along. Ooh, 36-month, 36,000-mile warranties. And guess what? You didn't need it. And then the Koreans came along. 10 years, 100,000-mile warranties. Guess what? You didn't need it because the cars didn't break down. They had a process called poka-yoke. You can't do things wrong because they prevent the problems instead of inspecting the problems at the end of the line. But hey, production, plan numbers, we got to make it. Come on, we got to have these number of rockets. But sir, no buts. Production or else. Oops, one rocket after the other is falling out of the sky. Now you see the problem? Very good. On August 18th of this year, a Russian Proton M rocket lost the prized Express AM4 satellite that was designed to provide digital television and secure government communications for Siberia and the Far East. Sorry, guys. You're still on rabbit ears. 1 week after the Express AM4 went off course, 1 week later, a Soyuz U booster malfunctioned, preventing the Progress M12M cargo spacecraft from reaching orbit. Its debris fell in Gorny, Altai, Russia. The loss of GLONASS satellites alone cost the state 4.3 billion rubles. That's $152.2 million. In 2010, President Dmitry Medvedev ordered the government to prepare a new federal program for GLONASS covering the years 2012 through 2020. The original 10-year 2001 program ends in 2011. Roscosmos said in June that the agency was looking for a funding of 402 billion rubles, that's $14.35 billion, for the program. Hopefully we still have dollars by the time that program ends. GLONASS is Russia's answer to the U.S. Global Positioning System, or GPS, and is designed for both military and civilian uses. That means you'll actually be able to drive those country roads in Russia and know where you're going without Google Maps. Both systems allow users to determine their positions to within a few meters. Russia currently has a total of 27 GLONASS satellites in orbit, although only 23 of them are operational. The complete GLONASS grouping must have 24 operational and 2 to 3 reserve satellites for the GLONASS network to operate with global coverage. As you know, the problem is there's a problem with the Fermi equations. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail, but your position on the Earth relative to the satellites, because the satellites are varying distances away from where you might be located, theoretically it's not supposed to work because the equations don't work out. But they've made corrections, automatic corrections in them that will allow you to stay located on a revolving planet underneath a set of satellites. So as that tension goes with production problems in Russian launch vehicles, which have really been quite reliable workhorses the last 15 years. We've launched a bunch of them, and they carry a whole bunch of stuff into space reliably and cheaply. Evidently, some of the components aren't working the way that they have worked in the past. They've had some supplier problems, as we do here. I drive a full-size Dodge Ram diesel pickup. I have to because I haul cars to the show. The interesting thing is that after a couple hundred thousand miles, I had to replace all the ball joints, which I did. I replaced the uppers and the lowers. So put the lowers, I put, you know, lifetime warranty because they carry the load of the vehicle. The uppers, okay, I went to AutoZone and I got the Value Craft ball joints. Wrong decision. Those ball joints are not made in this country. And they fell apart in 6 months. And the next set I put on there fell apart in 6 weeks. So I bit the bullet and bought Moog. Now, I got a refund for the cheap parts, but that's what happens. You have a ball joint go out in one of these rockets, it's toast. Okay, it probably wasn't a ball joint, but it could have been a gyro or a fuel pump or a valve. You know, trying to cut costs and maybe have something made in... Okay, you have it made in China and it doesn't work. Big surprise. China is in the news. Now, this is an interesting story, and I'll tell you why, because there's a story on top of this story. A couple of days ago, I believe it was Thursday, an article came out in Drudge Report with the headline, China Planning Surprise Missile Attack. I promise, that was the headline. I clicked on it. It went not to page not found. It went to kind of a parked page that said, this article has been pulled for some reason, or it's not accessible at this time. Please check back later. Well, the headline stayed up there for most of the day, so I kept clicking on it, clicking on it. Finally, it came up. So I read the article, which I'm going to read to you, but the most important part was in the comments section at the bottom. Let me see. I think I grabbed the comments section. I might not have on this particular one. No, I didn't grab the comments section on this one. The reason I go to the comments is some of the commentators on these articles are also bloggers. They know what they're talking about. Now, I thought it was just me. I actually tried to access this article from two different computers, two different networks, and I got the same message. Finally, in the afternoon, the article came up, and down in the comments, the guy said this article had been pulled and it was inaccessible for about 2 hours. It was only available from one source, and that was World Affairs Magazine. World Affairs Magazine got the article pulled somehow, but before they could pull it, it got copied on a couple other sources. It took a few more hours for the links to those other sources to get the article back out. And then World Affairs Magazine went live again because they said, well, there's no reason. We scooped the story. We launched it. So we might as well go out there with it. And now there are several sources of it. I want you to listen closely. A retired Chinese general recently revealed that his country might be planning a surprise missile attack on the United States. The public comment of Xu Gangyu came in response to WikiLeaks revelations that last year Washington had warned its allies beforehand of China's test of a missile interceptor. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, in a classified cable sent last January 9th, instructed American embassies in Australia, Britain, Canada, and New Zealand to notify those countries of upcoming Chinese launches 2 days later. The cable included details of the launch sites for the interceptor and the target, the models of the missiles, the purpose of the test, and the test date. That's a lot of information that we had. Yesterday, that would have been Wednesday of this last week, Hong Kong's South China Morning Post carried comments from Xu, now at the China Arms Control and Disarmament Association, to the effect that American satellites would have detected activity at the launch sites, but that some of the information in the cables, specifically the types of missiles and the date of the test, must have come from a source on the ground. WikiLeaks' release of this cable revealing one or more American spies in China's Strategic Missile Corps is perhaps the website's most significant compromise of U.S. security to date. The Hong Kong paper noted that Xu said that if China could no longer keep secret its missile launches, it would not be able to launch a surprise attack on the U.S. Let me explain that to you again. The Hong Kong paper, South China Morning Post, noted that Xu said that, quote, if China could no longer keep a secret its missile launches, it would not be able to launch a surprise attack on the U.S., close quote. Is China really in the process of planning to destroy the American homeland with a preemptive barrage of nuclear-tipped missiles? Xu's comment, of course, is not proof, but it does reveal that Chinese flag officers are thinking about doing so. Unfortunately, Xu's hostile sentiment fits within a worrisome trend, especially since the beginning of last year. There has been a series of belligerent comments from China's generals, admirals, and colonels, some talking about war with the U.S. in the near future. Last February, for instance, Colonel Meng, Xing Ying, said the People's Liberation Army would qualitatively upgrade its capabilities to force a showdown on U.S. policy toward Taiwan within the decade, when we're strong enough, for a hand-to-hand fight with the U.S. Given the bellicose statements coming from some of China's military brass, along with China's well-documented aggressive behavior in South China Sea and other peripheral waters, it is difficult to imagine how Western observers can deny China's intentions and the clashes that lie ahead. Thank you, General Xu. Interesting stuff. Because, you know, China's a global trading partner, a great supplier to many, many tens of thousands of U.S. businesses. One of the things that China's really good at is manufacturing stuff. We take the designs over there. We show them how to tool them, show them how to make them, show them the quality systems. They crank out the parts and ship them. Now, they got a long way to go to actually, you know, come up to the quality standards, and quality covers a lot of areas. It covers, you know, delivery time. It covers the actual quality, the materials used to make it. It covers the workmanship it takes to make it. And it definitely covers the warranty process. What happens if they ship you something that is defective in materials or workmanship? You return it? Are you kidding me? The cost of shipping it back is way more than the cost of just throwing it away. So you have to order 10 when you need 8. Is it really less expensive to produce in China? A question maybe we should ask ourselves as we watch our manufacturing jobs leave Main Street, go through Wall Street, and go to other countries. Okay, we've got about 30 minutes left in the program. Now, I want to cover this story on near-Earth objects. I didn't get the memo. I don't know if some of you did or not, but there was a workshop on near-Earth objects in Pasadena. Yep. The workshop has brought together leading representatives from space agencies and international experts to discuss key issues related to global response and cooperation in the event of a near-Earth object impact threat to Earth. Are you sure this is the first annual near-Earth object meeting where industry experts have come together? I'm sorry. How do you come up with industry experts in something like this? That's a good question. Hold on a second. I got to wet my whistle here. Okay. Now, the gathering of specialists took place August 25th and 26th in Pasadena, California. Yes, just west of Colorado Boulevard. The meeting was co-organized and co-sponsored by Action Team 14, part of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. As you know, just parenthetically, I was the spokesman for the Peace in Space Initiative, which was drafted by Alfred Lambermont Weber. This Peace in Space Initiative was supposed to be read to the General Assembly, but we didn't make it. Not enough support. Whew, my voice will hold up. You watch. All right. The Scientific and Technical Subcommittee, Secure World Foundation, and the Association of Space Explorers, that would be ASE, that represents over 350 individuals from 35 nations who have flown in space. So those nations have gone to space. And the supporting agency host of the meeting was the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, Near-Earth Objects Observations Program Office. And this recent workshop is a follow-up to previous meetings that took place last year in Mexico City to discuss an NEO information analysis and warning network. And in Darmstadt, Germany, to confer about NEO mission planning and operations group to plan, organize, and conduct any necessary mission to threatening asteroids. You see, this team was put together not to watch near-Earth objects, but to head one off. As we now have the technological capacity, we should be able to prevent the threat of an asteroid impact on Earth or mitigate its consequences, said Dr. Sergio Camacho, Secretary General of the Regional Center for Space Science and Technology Education in Latin America. Camacho is a former director of the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, and he held that post from 2002 to 2007. So he goes on to say, I am very pleased with the progress made at this workshop toward establishing a space agency mission planning and operations group to plan, prepare, and respond, if need be, to an asteroid threat. Preparing a draft terms of reference for such a group with the participation of four space agencies is a decisive step in that direction. So they're making substantial progress, and we're doing a lot of research to not only track these, but to get systems, at least in the planning stage, to be able to head one off. The Association of Space Explorers has been promoting international efforts to plan for averting a future asteroid impact for more than 5 years, and last week's Mission Planning and Operations Group meeting shows the world's space agencies are moving closer to cooperative action, said Tom Jones, former NASA shuttle astronaut and current chair of the ASE Committee on Near-Earth Objects. Jones said that the rules of the road for the group should lead to joint technology development to deflect a rogue asteroid. This might be why the funding for those much-beloved Venus projects was cut. Jones goes on to say, what's needed now is top-level agency endorsement of international planning and research, a la tax dollars, leading to a space demonstration of how we could change the course of an asteroid. That's the goal, so we can be ready for a hazardous asteroid down the road. So, our two movies, Deep Impact and Armageddon, sort of got the Hollywood juices flowing and got the public in line. And maybe we'll shake loose some funding so that we can actually do it should the need arise. Science fiction often turns into science fact. Kind of leads me into my next section here on home genetic engineering. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, for centuries, literally centuries, maybe millennia, botanists, animal breeders, and entomologists have been practicing genetic engineering in their own garages and basements. Everything from orchids to fruit flies to Saint Bernards have been hatched harmlessly by blending things artificially. With a few abstracts, the right glassware, and some simple household chemicals, the small independent labs all over the world are hatching out the next cure. Or are they? You know, the Apple computer was invented in a garage. Same with Google. Now, tinkerers are working at home with the basic building blocks of life itself. Using homemade lab equipment and the wealth of scientific knowledge available online, the internet, these hobbyists are trying to create new life forms through genetic engineering, a field long dominated by PhDs toiling in university and corporate laboratories. For instance, in her San Francisco dining room lab, 31-year-old computer programmer Meredith L. Patterson is trying to develop genetically altered yogurt bacteria that will glow green to signal the presence of melamine, the chemical that turned Chinese-made baby formula and pet food deadly. Quote, people can really work on projects for the good of humanity while learning about something they want to learn about in the process, she said. So far, no major gene-splicing discoveries have come out of anybody's kitchen or garage. Au contraire, But critics of the movement worry that these amateurs could one day get it and unleash an environmental or medical disaster. Defenders say the future Bill Gates of biotech could be developing a cure for cancer in the garage. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A little bit of used motor oil and formerly chewed gum, you never know what you can come up with. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Come on. The secret to life is clean glassware and conversion factors. And there are a lot of smart people out there. There are a lot of really smart people out there. And they don't want to take classes in English and social science. They don't want to take baking and sociology. But they're really, really good biochemists. Many of these amateurs may have studied biology in college, but have no advanced degrees and are not earning a living in the biotechnology field. Imagine that. Some proudly call themselves biohackers, innovators who push technological boundaries and put the spread of knowledge before profits. Yeah, baby, we like it. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a group called DIY Bio is setting up a community lab where the public could use chemicals and lab equipment, including a used freezer, scored for free off Craigslist, that drops to 80 degrees below zero, the temperature needed to keep many kinds of bacteria alive. Co-founder Mackenzie Cowell, a 24-year-old who majored in biology in college, said amateurs will probably pursue serious work such as new vaccines and super efficient biofuels. But they might also try, for example, to use squid genes to create tattoos that glow. Oh, yeah, that's the big discovery. Cowell said such unfettered creativity could produce important discoveries. He goes on to say, we should try to make science more sexy and more fun and more like a game. Patterson, the computer programmer, wants to insert the gene for fluorescence into yogurt bacteria, applying techniques developed in the 1970s. She learned about genetic engineering by reading scientific papers and getting tips from online forums. She ordered jellyfish DNA for a green fluorescent protein from a biological supply company for less than $100. And she built her own lab equipment, including a gel electrophoresis chamber, or DNA analyzer, which she constructed for less than $25 versus more than $200 for a low-end off-the-shelf model. Wow. Now that's science. Jim Thomas of ETC Group, a biotechnology watchdog organization, warned that synthetic organisms in the hands of amateurs could escape and cause outbreaks of incurable diseases or unpredictable environmental damage. Likewise, many are fearful that Planet of the Apes is not too far away. Perhaps this is just curiosity making its rounds. Perhaps the late Zachariah Sitchin was accurate when he translated the genetic mischief of the ancient Anunnaki in hacking out human genes from a variety of genes and a generous mix of their own. The question is, why program in the aging and death of such a beautiful and terrible being as mankind? Do you think with age comes wisdom and thus the foundation for peace? Do you think that mankind is ready for eternal life? Because it's just around the corner. Gene therapy and stem cell treatments are being synthesized as fast as funds will allow. And believe me, the funds are flowing nicely. If you think inventing sliced bread or the iPhone was a winner, wait until the guy or girl who finds a cream that grows natural hair cashes the first check. Better yet, wait until the wealthy can buy for themselves new skin that doesn't wrinkle or become peppered with age spots. Wait until we learn to grow a new limb or rejuvenate a heart or a liver. Wait until a single injection cures diabetes. Wait until the gene that stops the aging process altogether is found. I can tell you that the wait will not be very long. We will comb again. The question is, what do you think about the small, brilliant genius working in his own lab to find a cure or a treatment or solve a genetic riddle. Should they be allowed? Or do you only trust the large pharmaceutical giants with towers of glass and analytical equipment and lab animals? Should we be playing God at all? Yes? I think we can. I think we should. For good or for ill, we should explore and learn. It's our drive. It's our purpose. No planet within this galaxy has the variety of life living on it. Even with the loss of thousands of species every year, we will spawn new ones, and we will thrive forward like a sea of Genesis. Did you know that a new planet has been found only 36 light years away? It could be the most Earth-like world yet. The unpoetically named HD 85512b was discovered orbiting an orange dwarf star in the constellation Vela. Astronomers found the planet using the European Southern Observatory's high-accuracy radio velocity planet searcher, or HARPS, only one A, so don't get overreactive there. It's an instrument in Chile. Radio velocity is a planet-hunting technique that looks for wobbles in a star's light, which can indicate the gravitational tug of orbiting worlds. The HARPS data show that the planet is 3.6 times the mass of Earth, and the new world orbits its parent star at just the right distance for water to be liquid on the planet's surface, a trait scientists believe is crucial for life as we know it, at least on the surface. I just thought it was interesting. The distance is exactly the limit where you want to have liquid water. If you scale it to our system, it's a bit further out than Venus is to our sun. And at that distance, the planet likely receives a bit more solar energy from its star than Earth does about the sun. But after all, it is not really as bright as our sun. Various colleagues calculate that a cloud cover of at least 50% would reflect enough of the energy back into space to prevent overheating. On average, Earth has about 60% cloud cover, so partly cloudy skies on HD 85512b are not out of the question. Of course, clouds of water vapor depend on the presence of an atmosphere similar to Earth's, something that can't be detected on such distant planets with current instruments, and 36 light years is still just a little bit outside our range. You know, a while back, the Russians went out into space and they launched two probes to Mars. The first one died on the way there. The second one made it to Mars and was about to check out Phobos. Phobos orbits Mars below the synchronous orbit radius, meaning that it moves around Mars faster than Mars itself rotates. In fact, Phobos will eventually crash into Mars, although it's not clear how long that'll be, maybe 100,000 years, maybe less. Soviet Air Force Colonel Marina Popovich, now you know this name if you are a C2C listener or other leading programs out there. She's gone on record as stating that Phobos, one of the two Martian moons, is an artificial structure. Her sources also advise that it is hollow. The credentials of Marina Popovich are second to none, a PhD from the University of Leningrad and graduate of the military flight school. At the peak of her career, she set over 100 aviation records, of which 90 still stand unbroken. Her contacts on the subject stem from her former husband being the first man to rendezvous with another spacecraft in orbit during the Vostok 4 flight in August of 1962. Evidence for this arose in July 1988 when the Russians launched two unmanned planetary probes, Phobos 1 and Phobos 2. As I said, Phobos 1 was lost en route 2 months later, reportedly because of radio command error. And Phobos 2 was also lost under the most intriguing circumstances, but not before it had beamed back certain images and information from the planet Mars itself. Phobos 2 arrived safely at Mars in January of 1989. It entered into orbit around Mars as the first step toward its ultimate goal, to transfer to an orbit that would make it fly almost in tandem with a Martian moonlet called Phobos and explore the moon with equipment that included two packages of instruments to be placed on the surface of the moon Phobos. And the mission was successful until Phobos 2 aligned itself with the Martian moon. Then, on the 28th of March, the Soviet Mission Control Center acknowledged sudden communication problems with the spacecraft. TASS, the official Soviet news agency, reported that Phobos 2 had failed to communicate with Earth as scheduled after completing an operation yesterday around the Martian moon Phobos. Very interesting stuff. But there's more to it. I'm going to play an audio clip for you because it's important that we do it right here. This is a National Geographic special that was done. It's got none other than Carl Sagan on it. I know you're going to enjoy it. It's going to be very informative. It's about 7 minutes long, and here we go.
With the discovery of water on the moon and distant planets, the possibility of colonization suddenly becomes much more viable. Oxygen can be extracted from the water to be used in domed habitats on planets with minimal atmosphere. And water is one of the principal ingredients of rocket fuel. This find increases the possibility of unlimited treks across the stars.
We've had reports to the effect that the Viking equipment will never determine positively whether or not there's life on Mars. Can you set us straight on this?
Well, my own view is it's much too soon to decide whether we will have a definitive answer. It may be that there is an exotic biology on Mars. It may be that there's an exotic chemistry which looks a little bit like biology. There's a number of experiments to be done. They might decide the issue. They might not. But either way, Viking has been a biological success because the chemical explanation means that there is a kind of chemistry in the Martian surface which simulates some of the steps of chemistry in biology. We would learn something important about the origin of life.
In October 1988, the Soviet Union sends two unmanned spacecraft, Phobos 1 and 2, named for one of the Martian moons, to study the red planet. Phobos 1 is lost while on its way to Mars. But Phobos 2 arrives to orbit Mars and immediately sends images back to Earth. On March 1st, 1989, pictures of this unusual grid are received. The grid, here in the upper right, is shot both in the optical range and in the infrared range. Later, they are merged into this composite overlay.
Now, I just want to explain to you that this composite overlay shows a highly structured surface, like a grid, like streets, buildings, whatever. And this is not on Mars, but on Phobos.
On March 26th, Phobos 2 sends these images to Earth, taken just south of the equator. An unexplained elliptical shape appears.
This shadow actually appeared all of a sudden. Why am I calling it the shadow? Because you can see things through
this
it.
Is Dr. Harlamov, shadow, the Soviet
is it
Space
in Mars
Agency.
Atmosphere or on the planet's surface? One thing is for sure. This something is not positioned horizontal.
Well, to me it looks like a rocket taking off from the surface of Mars and leaving a trail behind.
Well, if you'd want to fantasize, it could be interpreted that way too. Now we think we ought to look at the real circumstances that have caused that trail, even though they haven't yet been fully clarified. That's more likely to be the shadow of some object, since surface elements can be seen through it.
How long will it take to process all of the information to get more or less objective scientific results, rather than fantastic ones?
Come back in a week.
1 week later, no details are given. Then, unexpectedly, this report.
Last year, the Soviets launched two spacecraft to the planet, both named after the Martian moon, Phobos. Their mission was to photograph Mars and land probes on its moon. One was accidentally switched off by a mission operator. But the second reached Mars and transmitted pictures that are still puzzling Soviet scientists. As it swung over the equator, it took pictures from a height of 6,000 kilometers. This is an infrared photograph. It shows differences in temperature. The dark patches are colder. This section covers 600 kilometers. It shows objects down to the size of 2 kilometers. It's the most detailed infrared picture of the planet's surface.
We have some very, very thin lines on the surface of Mars in the infrared, which means it's heat. I mean, it's not visible, it's heat. You could see us with clothes if you wanted to. These have a resolution, these have a width, I would guess, of 3 or 4 kilometers wide.
This is Dr. John Becklake with the London Science Museum.
I don't know, and the Russians aren't telling us.
Scientists are also puzzled by this shadow pictured on the surface of Mars by both optical and heat-seeking cameras. They're convinced it's a shadow because they can see objects on the surface beneath. But a shadow of what? Finally, there's the mystery of the vanishing spacecraft. The Russians have yet to release the last picture transmitted by Phobos before it lost contact with ground control. But the Russians have said that it shows an object coming towards the spacecraft, an object which, in their words, should not have been there.
The spacecraft was circling Mars, coming into the same orbit as the moons of Mars. And the last picture, about they got halfway through it, and they saw something there which shouldn't be there. Professor Kapitsa makes the joke that it's Martian people.
British scientists will be able to judge for themselves when the Soviets bring their pictures to a conference at Exeter next month. Because, of course, there must be a sensible explanation, mustn't there?
The Russians do not bring any pictures to the Exeter conference. How does the Russian space agency explain the spacecraft's destruction or disappearance?
It does take a minimum of precision criteria to obtain on the image these spots, which some would like to call flying saucers, that appeared within the visual field of the infrared range. It must be pointed out that the flying saucer version is not ours. Actually, at first we were saying that there was no flying saucer, that surely all that we saw could be explained in understandable, natural and physical terms.
One possibility could easily be that a small meteorite, a small bit of rock, was in the same orbit as Phobos and hit it.
In an exclusive interview conducted in October 1990 in Moscow, Professor Lev Mukin of the Soviet Space Research Institute discredits the meteorite theory.
There were attempts to hypothesize that there had been a collision between the space probe, which was then orbiting Mars in alignment with the orbit of Mars Moonlet, and strands of dust surrounding the moon Phobos itself. But some fairly accurate computations made by several organizations, and by our institute as well, have shown that this assumption is totally baseless.
If not meteorite or debris, then what could possibly explain the mishap? A long silence follows. Then in December 1991, Marina Popovich, former cosmonaut trainee and retired Air Force colonel, holds a surprise press conference at the Russian consulate in San Francisco. She unearths the mysterious last photograph taken by Phobos. There is a strange shape in the foreground. Colonel Popovich refers to this as an unidentified flying object, a UFO. The object is juxtaposed against what appears to be the planet's tiny moonlet, Phobos, for which the craft is named. But how is the mysterious shadow explained? The Russians say it is a shadow of some object on, or just above, the Martian surface. Upon further examination in April 1992, when all of the related photographs are compared side by side, scientists reach the conclusion that the shadow is actually moving. If Mars was indeed the site of a space base in antiquity, could the failure of these Soviet space missions be attributed to some sort of alien intervention? Could the ancient space base have been reactivated?
So, this is the important piece that I wanted to bring to you, because this mission, although it took place in 1988 and the information was delayed for a long time before the San Francisco press conference, we really haven't done anything since then. I would think that ahead of the Venus programs that are being so heavily lobbied for, at least in the press, from the Venusian teams crying foul, that this would be one of the top priorities, to get back to Phobos and find out what's going on there. Now, we have since have two or three satellites orbiting around Mars now and a rover running around on the surface still. Opportunity is now in its seventh year of operation. I would think that those things would also have been bothered by alien craft if they're still up there. Now, lots of points have been made that Phobos is artificial, that Phobos is maybe a fueling a station or planet put into place. It's got plenty of interior water. It has all the raw materials that you need to fuel up something that's traveled a long way across space and needs a docking station, needs some natural resource to be able to fuel back up again. And that's and there's a case for it out there, you know, being made that's what it's there for, that it's artificial, that it's placed in orbit, that the orbit can't possibly be one naturally formed because of its speed and its distance away from Mars. It's just one of those things that defies explanation. Add to that the fact that, let's see, I think this was in 1960, March of 1960. This is an article that was published. The Martian moon Phobos, generally accepted as a celestial body, actually may be an artificial satellite launched long ago by an advanced Martian race, according to Dr. S. Fred Singer, special advisor to President Eisenhower on space developments. No mention was made of other Mars moon, the other Mars moon, Deimos. In his published opinion, Dr. Singer backed a claim first made by the Soviet astrophysicist Shklovsky. The Russian scientist's announcement that Phobos was a hollow artificial satellite proving the existence of a Martian civilization set off heated arguments among astronomers. Shklovsky based his decision on a long study of Phobos's peculiar orbit. That's what I was just saying. Which other astronomers have noted. The Russian claim has calculations and those of earlier astronomers prove Phobos cannot possibly be an ordinary moon. Though Dr. Singer said the figures still had to be proved, his Phobos statement in the February Astronautics rejected other astronomers' objections. He goes on, well, the White House advisor said, "I would be very disappointed if it turns out to be solid," said the White House advisor. "If the figures were correct," he stated, "then Phobos undoubtedly is a hollow artificial satellite. If it is," he said, "its purpose would probably be to sweep up radiation in the Mars atmosphere so that Martians could safely operate around their planet." Dr. Singer also pointed out that Phobos would make an ideal space base, both for Martians and for Earthlings. So I appreciate you listening to X Squared Radio tonight. It's about 5 minutes till the top of the hour, and we will be back next week with more X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth explorers.